I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Today, I'm joined by Jennifer Michael Hecht, and she is a poet, an atheist philosopher, and a historian. She teaches at the New School in New York City. She has written poetry books and collections and a number of books, some of which you've probably heard of: Doubt, A History, The Happiness Myth, Stay, A History of Suicide, and The Philosophies Against It. And some of the things we'll be mentioning in the show are about suicide. And if you are listening to this program because you are thinking of suicide or contemplating it, I urge you to not do it. And there is someone who would like to talk to you. If you can contact the National Suicide Hotline, the number is 1-800-273-TALK, T-A-L-K. Jennifer, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
And I also hope to talk to you a little bit about some of your future projects too, beyond some of the books that you've written already too, if you're able to share some of that with us too. I have been following your work and kind of stalking all your podcasts, like I mentioned to you when I contacted you before, and finding your curiosity in a lot of science and history really, really intriguing, and probably we will be just an avid reader of all your work, because I really enjoy your curiosity of history and science. So thank you for providing all that reading material for me. So one of the things that intrigued me is kind of the eclectic mix that you have of really enjoying poetry, which seems quite a bit different than the other pursuits of history and science. And so I had heard in one of your talks that you started off sort of as a poet and then did history as sort of a practical thing. And maybe you could go into what led you to do that and what intrigued you about poetry in the first place.
Well, poetry really was, as you say, it was my first love, the first thing I felt extremely dedicated to and drawn to. But that was so early on. I really didn't know too much about how the world worked. I just thought I would be a professor and plan to go to graduate school and do that. And I really didn't know almost until I was applying whether it would be in history or English. I really didn't know too much about the MFA world. Mm-hmm. I don't think I knew about it at all, really. I knew I wanted a body of knowledge. I knew I kind of wanted to know everything, and history seemed like the skeleton. You could learn anything on top of it, and it would give you sort of a place to put it, a way to understand it contextually. And it seemed like with history, you could study art history, you could study film, you could study cultural studies. And I ended up going to Columbia in New York City and thinking I was going to study a sort of history of poetry and culture, but I just sort of fell into a course in the history of science, and I became just enraptured with it. It turned out to be a sort of poetic field in some ways, where you're really feeling around for what the relationship between science and culture is in any given moment, and how things change, how our whole worldview changes over time. And so that became, you know, to me, it was, in some ways, they were very related. But I was always still reading poetry and still writing it and going to readings and stuff. My first loves were very much the dead poets, you know, Emily Dickinson, and John Keats, and William Butler Yeats, and a lot of other ones who are no longer around, and some who are still around. But it really was until I was really, I guess, in college or graduate school that I started to discover modern poetry and sort of combine what I was doing with these newer pursuits.
Mm-hmm. And do you think your father was a scientist, or is still a scientist? Is still a scientist. And so do you think that your history of science had anything to do with that influence on you?
I think that it did, but I didn't mean it exactly. That is, it seemed like I was finding it entirely on my own. But yes, I'd grown up very much with the history of physics, and some chemistry, really the hard sciences, as very much a part of our sort of everyday lives. Yeah, absolutely. But when I took the history of science in graduate school, it was the history of the biological sciences. So it was a totally different world. Oh. But I was already somebody who knew a lot of science and who thought of science as my world. And I knew more about the history of science, I think, than I did even about sort of how to operate modern science.
And then what led you to write Doubt a History? I know sometimes people come to write, I mean, often people come to write about what they do because of a personal kind of inquiry or a background or something that they really want to find evidence for or search around for on their own enough to spend that much time on it. Was that your story or did it come
again,
from?
Not exactly, though. When I look back, of course, there was a relationship there. But I was doing my PhD in the history of science and also European cultural history. So I was still studying the poets and the artists, but I needed a dissertation topic, and I was interested in these late 19th century French anthropologists who were doing a lot of strange physical sciences, and yet they were very outspoken in their atheism, which was strange, especially for the time. And I found this Society of Mutual Autopsy. These guys and a few women formed this society where they pledged to, after death, dissect each other, and especially each other's brains, with the specific intention of, you know, forwarding brain science. But really, they were even more vocal about being against the Catholic Church, because the Catholic Church was very dominant in France at the time, and was in everybody's business in every different way. And so there was a tremendous amount of tension there. And they were sort of trying to prove to the Catholic Church that the soul doesn't exist. The Catholic Church at the time held that the brain is just sort of the almost like the throne of the soul, and the soul was doing the thinking. And so as Paul Broca showed in the middle of the 19th century, that he was the first one to find a direct relationship between an area of the brain. The third left frontal convolution of the brain is still called Broca's spot or Broca's area. And if you have a lesion there, you will have speech problems. And that's called Broca's aphasia to this day, 150 years later. So these anthropologists, Broca was among them. And he helped perform the first two autopsies, and then he died, and his brain was the third. So they did this for about 20 years with men and women all over France joining and usually leaving a lot of information about who they were so that a relationship could be drawn between their brain and them, their personality. And they all told why they were doing this. And it was very often anti-clerical. It was very often not wanting to give their bodies over to the church when they died. So they were very particular and interesting people. And it was a fascinating dissertation for me. I went to France and did the research. And when I was researching it in general, I found that there wasn't really a history of atheism anywhere that I could trust. It tended to be polemic to the point of not being even that useful. The believers would say that there's never been an atheist, and the atheists would say that sort of the best people were all atheists, and yet neither of them are true. It's hard for people to understand how a smart person could not agree with them. But to be a historian, you have to be able to do that. That's a really important factor. And I think because atheism was such a sort of dangerous and taboo and difficult subject, and because it had this reputation for polemics, that most people were involved because they were trying to prove a point, not do good history. So there really hadn't been a serious historian who'd sat down and written this up. I thought I basically knew the history and was going to write it up because I'd been an atheist since I was about 12, and I hadn't been doing the history of it, but whenever I studied any particular moment in history, I would be aware of it, and I would sort of almost take notes in my mind. So, but when I started to do the research, I was really amazed at how many people through history, whether in the Judeo-Christian tradition or in another tradition, had decided that they didn't believe any of the supernaturalism, any of the sort of anything outside of nature. And that happens all around the world. And I never found a moment in history where there weren't people who did not believe, who believed only the natural world. And the other amazing thing was how much these people all knew each other century after century. They were quoting each other. So there's a real historical tradition there. And also how fascinating these people were in terms of most of them didn't just say, no, I don't believe in karma. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in this or that. They also said, well, how do we make sense of life then? And how do we live? And they came up with these really rich and beautiful, evocative answers to these questions. And so that's one of the reasons that doubt got so big. One, because I was, when you're arguing that about, when you're talking about something that some people say doesn't exist at all, you kind of want to give a lot of the examples. But I certainly left people out. I still get letters from people saying, oh, you left out this person or that person. But the book is like 500 pages. But it's full of stories. You know, it's full of people's lives that I admired their lives. I admired their bravery. And I love telling their stories. And the, you know, people contact me all the time and say that that part meant so much to them because they understood history so much better, seeing it through these portraits that I was giving. But really also just to tell people this beautiful history of ideas about how to focus your life and have the richest life you can outside of these religious traditions.
Well, I have a question to kind of what one of the things that intrigues me about I haven't read the book Doubt. I've heard a lot about it, and I've read reviews and things like that about it, and so I was daunted by the 500 pages. So I'd like to pour through it, but one of the things that I'm curious about in the book is that when we're talking about the word atheism, is that really a word that people are using, or like at what point does this word really come out, or are people kind of like just disbelieving whatever it is that is kind of the going religion that is prevalent in their time and in their culture?
Yeah, the culture, the word itself is of course much later than a lot of these traditions, but it's been around for a couple hundred years, and in different languages at different times. Yeah, the there were long-standing alternative words that everybody understood as meaning that you don't believe in anything to do with religion, including God. And there were people who described themselves that way, but didn't use an exact word like that. And that makes a lot of sense in places where you could get killed for it. But a lot of people still came out and said what they believed, when, even when it was dangerous. But certainly, and in different times, it's called different things. You know, Plato talks in the Republic about how the youth these days are all atheists. And the word that he used is sort of a naturally translated word, which has been translated that way again for hundreds of years because that it was, you know, sp it specifically meant just that, you know, not believing in the gods. Of course, that, you know, got.
And I was just hearing, totally not related to your book, but somebody was just on. I'm kind of a podcast whore. I listen to a ton of podcasts, and someone was just relating the Jews coming out of Egypt as rejecting all of the deities of Egypt and going essentially irreligious and atheist in the sense of rejecting any graven images, and it's, that would have been atheist for that time and in that culture, and that in a way, different groups have spurred the gods of their
Absolutely.
time.
Absolutely. Indeed. I have many many religious fans who, that is, they say that they believe, but that the book explained a lot about religion to them. Because, you know, how do we get all these different religions? Even Protestantism is a direct rejection of Catholicism, which was the only Christianity that was in the West. And the Protestants said, you know, the Pope isn't the head of the church. There is no such thing really as the Pope. Pope's not in the Bible, so we're doubting it. And the Catholics said, you know, but there's so much of this that isn't in the Bible. And different Protestant sects rejected all of it. And so certainly we can say that. And that's one of the reasons I called the book Doubt, because I was guided by when people looked up and said, I just don't believe this. I don't believe the stuff we're doing. I don't want to do this stuff anymore. And every religion gets stuck in historical ruts. And sometimes people look up and say, oh, this was what our great grandparents did naturally, but we don't do it anymore. We're only doing it to fit in with this religion. Let's update the religion. Mm-hmm. But in most cases, that looks like atheism or the rejection of religion to the old guard. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. Then there are people who do look up and say the natural world seems sufficient for its it seems to grow by repeating patterns. The best patterns seem to repeat the longest. And we see all these kinds of changes going on around us right now. It makes sense that this is how the world works. And also people who simply travel or read travelogues and realize, wait, if I was born over there, I'd believe that stuff. And that is one of the key factors to making people doubt. And we live in such a cosmopolitan time, such a time of mixed cultures, that we really developed a kind of interfaith idea about God, because otherwise, you know, how could you sustain it? But now there's this sort of amorphous, very distant, and also very inner. You're supposed to be able to contact it inside, which has not been a staple of religions. And this very newfangled notion of God that kind of, oh, this one fits with all the religions, that's very much sort of made up to fit with our cosmopolitan times.
It does have to adjust, because it doesn't continue to work if it stays just tribal and it's different for every tribe.
Right.
You know, yeah. As people, you know, as we get interconnected, then it's like, oh, well, somebody's story has got to give. Right.
That's exactly
right.
So,
yeah, I think some of the scales come off at a certain point. And so a lot of people have been going, what's going on? So yeah, it gives a lot to think about. I think in the show notes, I'm going to include, of course, all the links to your books that we've been talking about, and give some people some food for thought. Now, I've mentioned this to you, but of course, there'll be a lot of Christians listening, and I'm not trying to throw anybody under the bus, but it does give us, I think, I want to have a lot of different perspectives on the podcast and a lot of different viewpoints. And I think it's important for us to see a lot of different sides and make up our own minds. I'm not trying to convert anybody or shove anything down anybody's throat, but I think it is important to see all different sides. That's why I felt it was so important to have you on. And I thought too that one of the very fascinating things you did with your book, Stay, is present an argument that I personally have not heard before, and maybe it is out there, but it tends to be that in modern times.
Go ahead. No, just saying, in a way I made it up, and then I went looking for it in history and was able to find people saying similar things and finding some enrichments of what I made up. But yeah, this was really something that wasn't out there.
Yeah, and so for people who don't know anything about your book, it is a secular argument against suicide, which is not, at least in recent modern times, usually the argument has been more individualistic, like hey, it's your life. Yep. If it's, or it's my life. If I want to kill myself, totally my right to do it, and screw you. Right. And not thinking about some of the community ramifications. And you can, obviously you'll be the better person to sum up than me, but it's a fascinating argument that I think is extremely important, especially when we see, especially like veterans who, it's 22 veterans a day kill themselves. And some of the really right. serious, in the little area in Pennsylvania where I live, it actually, we have federal funding pouring in because there's such a high per capita suicide rate here that we have a task force in this area. It's kind of the heritage of a mining town where a lot of immigrants came in the right. coal regions. It's a really serious issue.
Let me also tell you that the suicide is for people around 44 and from about age 15 to around 44. It is the third leading killer of Americans. Third. And then for the rest of the older set, from about 44 all the way up, to all the way up, it's the 10th leading killer. And the truth is, the older people do it more, but they're by then they're start to be swamped by cancers and heart disease and other things. So it looks like it's 10th there, but it's more numbers. Mm. So this is a national crisis of extraordinary proportions. Mm. We were shocked when researchers found that it had reached 30,000 a year in the year 2000. And by 2010, it was 40,000.
Oh,
and
my.
It's still going up right now. It's not going down yet. My research suggests to me that as much as you can see a relationship between circumstances and these deaths, it's also somewhat cyclical. I don't mean to be crude, but it's almost like hemlines. It goes up and down, and people like drug use, certain drugs, people use them a lot, and then you start to hear about the deaths, and it goes down again, and then they start again. With the suicide, it seems like it's when people, the more you've heard of other people who've done it, who are like you in age and gender and possibly profession, the more you feel like that's one of the solutions for a person like you.
It's like a social identity that you kind of see yourself in that person and start to think of it as a solution or something.
That's right. But you can very much link it to weight loss or weight gain or cigarette smoking or not, that these are people see themselves in a certain cultural context, and they do, when everyone's having two kids and then people start having three kids, you see a trend go up, and there's not always you can tell from the curve that it goes up and down so regularly sometimes. Oh. that it isn't always responding to circumstance. There's a lot of meaning in this. I want to first say that this is an entirely secular argument against suicide, though in Stay I do mention a lot about how religions have seen suicide. But I want to add that nowadays the religious prohibition against suicide is not very strong, and many Christians and other believers take their lives and leave a note that says, I think God will understand. Mm-hmm. So they need this information too. Mm-hmm. And I hear from them too. Mm-hmm. The two main arguments are community and your future self. The community one is, there's a lot of ways of explaining it. It's certainly clear that people need you and love you and would be very harmed if you take your life. But what we don't usually see is, for one thing, that it is very influential, so that when somebody takes their life in a school, it is common for the suicide rate there to go up. And when a celebrity takes their life, we can see a jump in suicides. Also, age and gender seem to match up. We see certain professions where, if cops are doing it, more cops start doing it for a while. And so you're really saving somebody's life if you can stay alive through your sadness. I put it in the book that, you know, if you want your niece to make it through her dark night of the soul, you have to make it through yours. And you know, an ex-army ranger who read the book, or I think he read an article about it in the Times, a David Brooks article, a column about my book in the Times, where he quoted me saying that about the niece. And and this ex-army ranger said, you know, from that he got, yeah, if you want your ex-army ranger friends to stop killing themselves, you have to take care of, you have to stop saying no to the help that's being offered to you, because the best way you can keep them alive is to keep yourself alive. And you know, that it's let me say also that I am not talking about end-of-life care. I think people are just, you know, I think that that's a totally different issue. Mm-hmm. If you're dying of cancer, that's a totally different issue. And I've expanded that to the point of saying that if even one friend, family member, or medical person also thinks you might have had enough and this might be a reasonable decision, then you're in a different category. I'm not really talking about you, though some of these insights may be of use. I'm talking about the many, many people who do this, and they even know at the time they're doing it that everyone will think it was a tragedy. Even if they say they think they were a burden, they know no one would be happy with this decision. They know no one would say, yeah, go ahead. Even themselves in another mood. They even know sometimes that they're sort of outsmarting all their other moods. And that is what I'm asking people to just take a moment and think about it. So that if you think about it, look, we all sometimes have a homicidal thought, right? If you got road rage for a minute, somebody cuts you off, you think, or a rival at work, or these thoughts go through all animals' heads, I think. And but the point is, you don't, when you get a thought like that, you don't say, should I really do that? Is my brain giving me important information about what I should do? And suicide is very similarly controllable. I've heard from many, many people. And I myself get ideation sometimes. That is, the idea of wanting to die comes to my mind when I'm upset. I've asked so many people, and I've read so many things. I don't know a definite number, but I would say upwards of 85% of people think of it now and again.
In terms of like, everything's going terrible, maybe it would just be better if I was gone, kind of like that,
yes,
thought.
Yes, yeah, that's right. Not right. Planning. I think planning is probably
step,
half or less.
That's a step two kind of thing, right?
That's right. But I think that many people are very, very disturbed by their occasional suicidal thoughts. And I think if they realized how common they were, and that they're similar to homicidal thoughts in that they don't mean you're going to do it. They don't mean you should maybe do it. They don't even mean you have to think about doing it. People find that very liberating to realize that that's just that it's a very common, and that it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to do it. Indeed, we have data that suggests that 95% of people who try it, if they live through the experience, will never try it again. We hear about the ones who do it over again until it works. So you think that anyone who does it is likely to do it again. But no, that is not the case. And people who are saved from doing it, this is common. You can hear people say how glad they are that that they didn't end up doing that. And that's the future self part. I'm asking people to just try to remember that, you know, they're going to be a very different person in 10 years, that now they know a lot of things they didn't know 10 years ago. And while I don't believe you have to have faith in something that you don't have evidence for, I certainly believe you should have faith in the possible love of the community and care of the community, and in the possible, you should have faith in your future self, that she or he may be able to take better care of you than you're able to right now.
And, you know, there are some people, and I felt this way too, especially in adolescence, and I had a little rough time of it.
Sure.
And I felt really lost in my pain. I couldn't see out of it. I was really trapped there. And I did feel like maybe it'll get better someday, but I don't know how. You know, there's dark, dark times sometimes, and you think maybe dawn will come, but I don't know how to get out. It just hurts really bad. And I guess, you know, in those times too, community seems like the way out too. Like that's, you're there, you're staying for community, but it also seems like community is how, is the lifeline as well. And I'm wondering, like, what do you see as, and I'm also wondering, this is a separate question. I'm sorry for freestyling on you here, but is this an American problem and a Western problem more than other countries, or what do you see?
No, we're up to worldwide. It's around 1 million a year. And the WHO study, World Health Organization, I think it was about a decade or more ago, said that in the last, I think, 45 years, suicide was up 60% in the world. What guides that is different in different places, but perhaps not as different as we used to think. My book, Stay, it really is not about the East. It's about the West. Mm-hmm. But since then, I've learned more. And most of what I learned about the East is contrary to some of the common things we say. I think in the East and the West, first of all, depression is not always involved, and depressed people don't always kill themselves. That suicide is more impulsive than we used to realize. So if you can get past that bad night or even that bad hour, you'll be all right, which is one of the reasons why a conceptual argument works, because you know, if you just it's why suicide bridges work. People don't go just do it another way. They get thwarted, and by the time that happens, they're already moving past it. But it's I personally believe that very often it's about shame, that we have some idea about ourselves, maybe particularly in some person's eyes. And you know, in 2012 there were more suicides in the military than deaths in both wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's both combat and transport accidents. So everyone says, oh God, the horrors of war, but then you look at the details and a full third of them had never been deployed, those suicides.
And they were just here in
A third of them were not deployed. A third of them had been deployed once or were over there for their first time. And only that last third had been deployed more than once. So, but on the other hand, more than 50%, a good deal more than 50%, you could find in the, you know, when you interview people and when you read the suicide note, that these people had suffered a humiliation in the last 3 months, a humiliation or a loss of a major relationship, humiliation at work usually, or in romance, or a loss of a major relationship. And so, and we also see when a celebrity takes their life, we see the jump lasts around 3 months. With people of their age, gender, or some other similarity. So it does look like we can put ourselves on guard for this. Look, if 40,000 Americans are taking their lives every year, we have to see that a lot of them didn't think that that's what was going to happen to them. So it's horrible, but it has to be that some people who are listening to this now and thinking this isn't about me, something could happen to them that makes them feel they cannot reconcile that event with the image that they have of themselves. And if they know of someone who's done it, or if they are influenced by a celebrity who's done it, they should know ahead of time that if they're feeling that pull, they should be on guard against it. And it works. People, when the book first came out, I got a lot of argument about it, that it wouldn't work, that people couldn't think rationally about it. But it turns out to really not be the case. And I hear from too many people who say it does work. Mm-hmm. And there have been too many reviews who say, I was always thinking I might kill myself, and now I know I won't. And yeah, I get very moving letters telling me as much. And
it's also, it's kind of like it's a little bit of like a heads up. Hey, this might happen. You might think this thought. And then you know when it comes, oh, there it is. That's what, and it's a little bit of it's a little heads up for down the road, this could happen. And when it does, don't do that crazy thing, because it is fatal,
Right. And another way I put it is don't let your worst mood murder all your others.
Mm, yeah, very good.
All your other moods don't want to do that.
Right.
And so, and that mood will have the reins for a minute. But when it picks up the reins, if you're on guard against it and say no, you can move fast it so much that, I hear from people that, at first it's almost a burden that they realize, oh, I can't just think about escaping. Now I have to give all the thought I was giving to escaping to how to fix this. Mm. And of course, it isn't easy. Depression happens to you. Suicide doesn't. Suicide is a behavior. So I can counsel, we can talk about getting away from it. But yes, you'll still feel pain. But one of the things I talk about in Stay is that in the secular world, especially, but even in the modern religious world, the pain is not seen as redemptive. I wouldn't wish pain on anyone. If I could make all the pain disappear, even though I don't know what it would be to be human without it, mm-hmm. I would do it. I don't want pain. I don't want anyone else to feel it. Mm-hmm. I've felt intense pain in my life, both physical and emotional, mental, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody for whatever. But we also see that the great leaders and the great thinkers and the great innovators very often have some extreme depression in their past that taught them the humility and a version of courage that may not feel like courage at all, but it taught them that no matter how great they think they are or how accomplished they are, that they're human in this really deep and vulnerable way, and they learn to extend that vulnerability to others, both in their artistic or writing work or in their leadership. Mm-hmm. So as much as, again, I wouldn't enter into pain if I had a choice, and I take it away if I could, but we're stuck with it. We might as well notice that it seems to help us grow. Mm-hmm. And the more we talk about that, the less we blame ourselves for it. In this culture, we literally blame ourselves. So on top of the pain, we're mad at ourselves for not being happy. Mm. And that's a culture that's really forgotten what it is to be human. It's very problematic.
Yeah. And what you're saying is reminding me just how hard Robin Williams' suicide hit me. I was crying about it, and I for days, and I not entirely for days, but once in a while I'd be a really bright light left this world by his own hand, and he was obviously depressed and he had other issues going on. I did not know the man. I enjoyed his work, but what was sad was that he died alone by his own hand, and a lot of people also suffered because they enjoyed him. They enjoyed him being around.
More than that, I think it was he often took these acting roles where he was the kind of life coach guru kind of find the beauty in it.
Yeah, right.
And so for that person, but we really have to revise. The new information has come out that that this wasn't about depression, and that in fact he had this biological but with mental consequence disease. The autopsy found it, and his wife at the time said that she did not think it was about depression, but rather this disease that makes you really lose touch with reality and also have Parkinson's-like symptoms, and that with it he would have died anyway within a few years. And he was losing one faculty after another. I still don't, you know, I still feel kind of brokenhearted, yes, that he was alone, that we know that he took a knife to his wrists for, you know, that it was all so makeshift. And that means that maybe if someone had been there, so my heart's still a little broken about it too. But
it was a little different story than it first came out.
That's right. Yeah. And you know, but I do think that for the year that we didn't know that, there were certainly people who felt sort of drawn to it because of that, and who felt very heartbroken because of that. Yeah, it's a complicated issue, but I definitely put him in a sort of different category.
Yeah. And also once it's out there, and like your book says, once it's out there as Robin Williams' suicide, people who identify with him, whether it was really a suicide or not, people who identify with him might say, well, then me too, or whatever, you know, because it, like you're saying, the social component can be there, and there can be some, you know, that issue can happen. But
sociologists have found it conclusively over and over. I want to just add one quick thing in response to one of the things you said about adolescence, and it's important for people to know that the prefrontal cortex of the human brain is not finished growing until you're 25. And that area of the brain is executive function. It's what helps you get your needs met and do the steps you need to make your wishes come true. The planning and the execution. And it's also a big part in social success. So that until you're 25, you have a special reason to hang on and see what happens next, because you really don't know. I think that that's also true for older people. It certainly seems like we grow into different phases of our lives. Nationwide, the sociologists have sort of come up with that people are happiest sort of into their 20s with a sense of possibility, and then it starts to get harder, but then starting at 50 it starts to get happier again. So what's happening, whether that is a sort of social construction that you start to say to yourself, okay, this is me, I'm not gonna try to be something I'm not anymore, and you start to relax your censorship of yourself, or whether it's a biological change, we don't know. So there's reasons for everyone to think, just because you don't know it now, but especially if you're under 25, find a way to hang in, because you really don't know. But I hear from people in college that age saying that the realization that they'd put their friends at risk is what sort of really works for them the most emotionally, even though they're the ones who would be the most, associated with the idea of your future self. But yeah, for younger people, it really is something that, and we need to talk about it, because people think you give young people the idea when you talk about it, but we have really good studies that show that young people think about it.
Yeah, and I think we need to sort of give an inoculation that there are resources, there is help, and we need to be there for each other, because as we we talk about it, we get stronger to help each other. Because if it becomes this taboo subject, like, oh, we better not say anything, then what are you supposed to do when you need to talk about it? You know, then you can't. So
that's right.
Yeah,
and you know, I mean, one of the reasons for stay is that we're living in a culture where we are constantly telling each other to get help, but we don't always tell each other why, and people don't. So way more than half the suicides that happen on campus, the people were not they were not sort of clients or patients of the mental health facility on campus. They didn't go. And that, again, has to do with the impulse. They didn't know they were depressed. They got a bad grade. They got a few bad grades, or somebody broke their heart, and they couldn't see themselves that way. And they did it rather impulsively. That's what you hear these people who seem like they had everything, you know, good looking and, you know, in sports and, and, you know, generally great grades and, you know, really without consulting almost anybody, they just couldn't face some major reversal. And the truth is, we all know that just reaching out for help, it doesn't always work. Sometimes you don't want to talk to anybody, and it doesn't feel like anyone wants to talk to you. Sometimes I think that our culture is so, we've been saying to each other, here are the warning signs to look for in each other. And we have to start also looking for the warning signs in ourselves, and talking about the real reasons to stay, because it works. I have all sorts of different statistics for showing how a community that knows that it's needed, even if it's more depressed than your average community, the suicide rate goes down for that duration. Certainly young mothers, but that is people who have children under 18. They're even though the depression rate, I mean, is higher in that group than any other. The postpartum and other situations can be very hard, but the suicide rate goes down because that is one group in this culture who knows that they're needed. I get letters from fathers who thought that, you know, oh, she'll find a guy who has a better job and who isn't depressed all the time and who can be a better father, and it'll be better for everyone. And only after reading my book do they realize, no, they'd just be giving their kids a father who took his life. And that will be a burden for the rest of their lives, like a burden, a fatal burden.
If you're like 40% more likely, the children of a person who committed suicide are 40, is it 40% more likely to take their own lives?
The best study seemed to say four times as likely, which is, yeah, it's just a different way of talking about it. But there are some circumstances where it's two times or three times, but where, you know, people also have to remember, first of all, these studies are really careful about weeding out any people who, they're really careful about trying to figure out whether there's a biological component. So a lot of people are just cut out of the study. The researchers say if we looked at everybody, the rate would be much higher. But we are trying to be really careful. And they've compared it to, you know, if you lose a parent in an accident, does the suicide rate go up and not like this? If your parent is hospitalized for depression, does the suicide rate go up for the kids? Not like this. So it's the act itself. And you also have to remember, when you're talking about a kid taking their life, you're probably talking about a couple of hospitalizations for trying first. You're talking about a tremendous amount of misery. And another way we know that it's not genetic is that the age the child is when the parent does it changes the child's outcome in these ways that are pretty, you know, graphable.
And it is true that if you're in a mood and you're thinking about doing it and you don't feel like doing anything good for yourself, that sometimes just thinking about other people and what it might put them through is enough to get you through that mood. And
it is. It's, you know, just the problem that sometimes we're very mad at someone and we think that this will show them. The problem is we really have to remember that you don't get to choose who suffers from your suicide. You know, your mean stepmother might actually get more attention from it. You know, she might not suffer the way you want her to. She might get something out of it. And meanwhile, a friend or a distant friend, somebody who you knew a little bit a few years ago, might end up in a fatal circumstance from it. So we really have to remember that the anger, you know, and a lot of, certainly I know people see a lot that's wrong with Freud. And of course there was a lot that's wrong with Freud, but I also think he was quite a brilliant, and he gifted us a great deal of understanding about how the psyche works. And he certainly thought that suicide was always anger at someone else, someone that you couldn't bear to be angry at. So you become furious at yourself.
Well, I know this, the book Stay came out in 2013, I think. Yeah. And a lot, it's still, I still hear about it a lot. And so I'm so glad that it's had such an impact and continues to have such an impact. I didn't even realize it came out when it did, because I've heard so much about it, and I'm thrilled that it's, and I'm sure going to continue to have such an impact, and it needs to, because this is kind of the conversation that's been long overdue, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I know you're, what are you working on now, and what's kind of occupying your time as you write now?
Well, I'm working on a book called The Wonder Paradox. It's about poetry in a lot of ways, but in some ways it's the next step from Doubt, and in some ways from Stay, and my book The Happiness Myth, which was another kind of cultural analysis of how we think about happiness today and how we try to get it in comparison to how other people at other times have tried to get it, and what we can learn about those differences. You know, who's crazier, the culture that makes women wear corsets, or the culture that says, you know, wear a loose fitting t-shirt, but we want to be able to see your bones, right? I mean, mm-hmm. At the time of corsets, there wasn't really an idea of thinness. Mm. It was just a matter of being hourglass. Mm. And so when you start to notice the pressures that different societies put on you, you start to be able to free yourself of some of them, of realizing that some of them are kind of nutty. Mm. The 19th century thought that the heart would wear out if you used it too much. So if you had health problems, you should not exercise. The truth is, of course, exercise turns out to be good for us. But it's also true that if you overdo it, if you become a real gym nut, fatalities start to go up from it. Mm. And we know of lots of sports people who. So these overall, this is very much out of the history of science, that I was looking at happiness from a point of view of the history of science. So the book that I'm working on now is really saying that for a lot of people today, religion is much less central to their lives. And the millennial generation, the fastest growing religious group is people who describe themselves as none, that mm-hmm. they do not they're not in any religion at all. Mm-hmm. Not all of them call themselves atheists, but many do. And so what, for instance, do those people do when it's time to get married? Mm-hmm. Where do you marry? Who marries you? What do you say? And what I see is that people use poetry to conjure the secular sacred, mm-hmm. to say something that's stirring and deep and meaningful and encouraging and inspiring, and also a little instructive, mm-hmm. that in many ways poetry is replacing more old style sermons or Bible quotes. And the thing is, nobody's really talking about how it's done, what's the best one to choose, how to introduce it, so it's not just sort of mumbo jumbo that has the word love in it a bunch of times. And we do tend to choose very, you know, there are a bunch of poems that are very popular as wedding poems. It's similar with funerals, that we look to poetry in times of great disaster. We look to poetry. And I also think the whole question of the two big things of living without the religion that our culture is sort of coming out of, or some of our culture is coming out of now. Mm-hmm. We had a religion that offered meaning and an afterlife. Now, most religions don't offer an afterlife. Most people, this is something I say that I don't see anyone else saying, but I can prove it so easily. I mean, all the Confucians through history, there are millions of people, and generation upon generation, no afterlife. 5,000 years of the Egyptian civilization, and the afterlife was just for the pharaoh through mm-hmm. most of that time, and then the rich could buy in at the very end. Mm-hmm. But most people through most of history accept death the same way you accept that you can't fly. There are things that are just there, and you just accept them and you cope with them, and it makes you focus on life in a different way. Well, Christianity in particular, located meaning and how to think about death with God and religion. And because of that, people who have doubts or who no longer have faith in those ideas feel very sad about those two things. They wish there was meaning, and they wish there was an afterlife. Mm-hmm. And I think that those things are a sort of mistake of a way of thinking. I think that meaning always came from culture and community, and that ritual and beautiful ideas help that, but that these things are, you know, the ancient Greeks, when they became atheists, they didn't mourn the loss of meaning because their gods never gave them meaning. Mm. They missed the gods because they didn't visit them in dreams and give them advice anymore, but they didn't miss an afterlife because their religion had never offered them an afterlife. Mm. So what do we do about these things now? And again, I find that the great poems in history and some of the modern ones can give us a tremendous sense of help with these. Just to pick one little one of there's a Keats poem. Keats' mother had died of tuberculosis, and he had, you know, nursed her throughout her illness, and then his brother did too. And now he's in his 20s and he starts coughing blood. Mm. He knows he's dying. Mm. And he knows what a great poet he is. And he writes this poem. It's relatively short, but it starts, "When I have fears that I may cease to be." And he describes that a little about the writing he won't do and the love he won't have. And then he says he goes down to the shore to think, till love and fame to nothingness do sink. So here's his testament. He doesn't fall on his knees. He doesn't go to a church. He never mentions believing in either God or certainly not anything Christian. And here instead, when he's brokenhearted about mortality, he goes to the ocean. We've all gone to the ocean or some large body of water and felt changed by it. We feel overwhelmed by the night sky or overwhelmed by the ocean's size, and we realize that we're sort of part of something that's very large and strange, and we're very tiny. Mm-hmm. And we're also very significant. Mm-hmm. You know, the universe has 100 billion galaxies in it. And each of those galaxies have millions of stars. And we're a sort of normal-sized galaxy, and we're in one of its little spiral arms, midway out, not particularly central to anything. Mm. And an Earth can fit into the Sun 1 million times.
Yeah.
And we're these tiny little things, and there are 7 billion of us. And yet, our little minds can take in all of that.
Yeah.
So our little minds are just as extraordinary as this vast universe. Mm. And indeed, they are the greatest mystical, weird, magical thing that I can think of. I mean, consciousness is weirder than virgin birth by far.
Yeah.
This gray meat in your head not only thinks, but wrote all the symphonies. Gray meat wrote all the symphonies,
for sure.
Wrote all Shakespeare's plays. So the bizarre fact of in all the universe, Alan Watts, great Buddhist thinker, said that an ocean wave. A wave is the ocean waving. You know, you can't take the wave out of the ocean. Mm-hmm. In the same way, you are the universe you-ing. Mm. It's, you know, the universe became you for a moment and eventually will unbecome you. But here we are. We are these tiny, tiny, tiny nodes of the universe that woke up and saw itself. Mm. We are the universe seeing itself and marveling.
I mean, how can you not get completely blown away?
So you, and when you either read poetry that brings you to these ideas or go to the ocean and get a kind of intimate, intimation, right? That it's not something maybe that you can think through, but you feel that bigness. And you tend, human beings tend to be moved away from the shock and fear of mortality with those kinds of experiences and towards a kind of letting go, a kind of, I'm part of this, I'm part of the flow, and this universe is so much bigger than me, I can't control it, which is freeing, and we feel better.
Yeah.
So, you know, there it is. And the magic of Keats's poem, it has an added dimension that he wrote this thing, you know, a couple hundred years ago. And because of the beauty of the words, because of the art, it comes to us. And we can experience it without even necessarily going down to that beach.
So that's kind of the magic of the poetry. It can kind of like nibble at the edges and then cut straight into the heart of something.
Right.
And allow you to feel that wonder and that sort of truth that sort of hits everybody in that same sweet spot.
Right. And that's why it's called the wonder paradox, because you can explain the human experience and human race in a lab, but that's not where we live. That's not how we live. Where we live is in a place where wonder is available to us. And we can, you know, we can advance it so that we have some comfort in this very strange life.
Yeah. And that's the kind of people that I love to speak with are the people who aren't just stuck in terror and and can appreciate the joy and the mystery and the wonder. And usually when you do that, there's enough joy to go around that you, you know, you feel like, you know, trying to help the other guy out. You know, you feel like, you know, everything is going to be okay.
The thing is, I have to say that I do see myself as both an optimist, but somewhat dark inside. I experience life with a great deal of struggle. I wrote Stay because I lost two people, sort of from my past, but I cared very much about them, to suicide. But, you know, it took a while for me to realize that I was also writing for myself and for some friends who I knew skirted that edge. But yeah, for myself too. I don't feel like, just because I can encourage people and I can encourage myself and I can make art, which takes a tremendous amount of courage. And the Wonder Paradox will talk also about that, how in a sort of finite life you can try for something beyond yourself, even though it's so hard, you know. But I definitely don't come from a position of it'll all be all right exactly. I come more from a position of, if your heart's broken, come sit by me and let's have some tea and look at the fire. It's definitely, I see life as awfully difficult. I know for some people it's not, but for most people, I think it is, at least at times.
Yeah. And I think when I say it's all going to be all right, I think I'm talking about the universe.
I have no idea about
the rest of it, but you know, it's been going on for a pretty long time. So
that's right. Exactly that, you know, it's sort of beyond our ability to control. So it does give you a little bit of a, but we also know, you know, that quote that Eleanor Roosevelt says that it never underestimate what a small group of dedicated people can do. In fact, you know, everything that's ever been done has been done that way. I'm paraphrasing, but so we are responsible for the world in some ways. I do think sometimes, you know, with Stay, sometimes just persevering is a gift. And and I think that the culture owes gratitude to people who can do that. And let me say it, if you're listening out there and hanging on because you know it's the right thing to do for yourself and for other people, thank you. Thank you. You have our gratitude. Yes, you have my gratitude.
Is there any poem that you would like to read as we finish up our conversation here?
Sure. Let's see. I picked a couple because you had said, let me see what I would. Well, I can give you.
And also I can include one if you want to just read one, and then you can send one along, and I will include a little special surprise on the show notes, that one that you don't read, and then it'll be.
Okay. Terrific. Then I'll just read, a little one, from my first book. This is called History. It might surprise people a little bit in that we've been talking about atheism, and the characters in it are sort of biblical, but they're such wonderful stories because they really resonate with people. Anyway, History. Even Eve, the only soul in all of time to never have to wait for love, must have leaned some sleepless nights alone against the garden wall and wailed, cold, stupefied, and wild, and wished to trade in all of Eden to have but been a child. In fact, I gather that is why she leapt and fell from grace, that she might have a story of herself to tell in some other place.
Thank you so much. This has been so nice, and I really appreciate that you would come on.
Thanks. It's been lovely for me, too. Thanks for the great questions, great conversation.
If you are listening to this program because you are thinking of suicide or contemplating it, I urge you to not do it. And there is someone who would like to talk to you. You can contact the National Suicide Hotline. The number is 1-800-273-TALK, T-A-L-K. Show notes for this episode can be found at sparkmymuse.com. There you'll find details for websites and people and books mentioned in this episode, and sometimes you'll find photos and videos too. Please stop by and check it out.